holy war. I don't mean that in a jihadist sort of way. I don't mean it in a Batman sort of way. No? Okay. Somebody got that, right? Breaking the ice. The holy war. Because I'm the first teacher through this book, I have the responsibility, you might say, of introducing it and giving some background information, and so I'm going to do that. Let me just start by saying that this teaching that we're going to do, in some books, it might be okay. You'll listen to somebody teach the book, and maybe you won't read it, and you might be okay. But this is definitely not one of those books, because it's very, very personal. If you've not read it, I would almost say you have to. So then our job then is going to be maybe whet your appetite to read it so you'll go into it with a little bit of understanding and knowledge. I actually had never read it before I was asked to teach it. So it was a new thing to me as well. John Bunyan is the author of Holy War, and he was born in 1628. Let's see. He was born in 1628. He died in 1688. He was 60 years old when he passed away. And he was a prolific writer. He's known for a number of different things. He was imprisoned for preaching without a license. I believe it was in Bedford. And so he is very much, he was very much, maybe was one of the first ones that would have planted the seeds, being a Baptist, of religious freedom. So in my mind and in my understanding and my thoughts, he's very, very valuable. Men like that who are willing to even be incarcerated for the idea of religious freedom. He, as I said, was a prolific writer. He's best known for his allegorical works, obviously The Pilgrim's Progress, and we studied that last summer. And then this is also another allegory. So we have to remind ourselves when we go into reading and studying this book, it's allegorical, or it's symbolic, you might say. Okay, so things represent real things, but they're representative or represented by other things. But he's written a number of books. One of them was an autobiography called Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. You might have heard that title. That's actually his autobiography. He also wrote a novel, allegorical novel, called The Life and Death of Mr. Badman. I'd never heard of that before. And he is, and these things are famous for their literary merit. And of course, he living in the 17th century, you think when he was writing, there was no USA, there was no United States of America at all. In fact, he was born just 15 to 17 years after the King James Bible was translated, so a long time ago. And yet, the things that he writes are so for today. He was. In his life, in his own life, what was important to him and what was special to him comes out in his writings. The idea of the portrayal of man's sin. Now, if you read Pilgrim's Progress, and it's even more so, I think, in Holy War, just the way he portrays man's sin and the subsequent grace of God to save that sinner and the nature then of the Christian life. These were themes that for Mr. Bunyan that were very, very important to him, and it was his passion. He also wrote some other things that were more theological. For example, he wrote an exposition on the first 10 chapters of Genesis. So there's a lot of things that he wrote. I suppose being incarcerated and in jail, you have time to write, I suppose. Or maybe he assumed that he was kind of a Paul in that way. Now, we would not pick up the 1611 version of the Bible and probably understand it very well. So seeing as he was writing in those same times, the original version of Holy War is also difficult, would be difficult for us to understand. So people have reread it, have rewritten it. And Ethel Barrett is one of those. She was born in 1913. She was a Sunday school teacher, and she took on a boys Sunday school class. I think they were called the Boys Brigade class, and very unruly. Hard to control. Maybe some of you understand what she went through. And so to keep them in better control and to get their attention, she began to be very lively in her presentation of things. And she gained a certain amount of fame from that, and actually was on radio for a while. She's from Schenectady, New York, New York State there, in the Finger Lakes region. That's where she's from. And she then became was on local radio stations, and probably her most prolific time was, or I don't know if prolific is the right word, but the time when she was most well-known is maybe in the 50s to late 50s. So that's Ethel Barrett. She's rewritten this, and she called it The War for Man's Soul. But it's just rewritten in a way that would certainly allow us to understand. Now, there are some things that she left out, from this version that were in the Holy War, and I'll bring up a couple of those things as we go along. Well, let's talk about the Holy War as a book. Now, this book was written during Bunyan's first 6 years of imprisonment. And, of course, you may understand, he was forced to have a license to preach. And he didn't believe he needed a license to preach. He used scripture passages such as 1 Peter chapter 4. It says, if any man teach, let him teach as the oracles of God. And so he would say that the Lord then tells somebody to preach and not some license or some denomination, which is certainly something we would agree with. And so his life and his teachings ring, they resonate with us, being a Baptist. And so because of this, he was one of those early voices for religious freedom. Holy War, then, unlike Pilgrim's Progress, and I think it's important to understand this. With Pilgrim's Progress, you read that, and you follow Christian's walk along. It's kind of like you're sitting back and you're looking at Christian's life, right? And you see him going through the Slough of Despond and all of these things, and so you're outside of looking in, as if you're looking at a movie, you might say, or something like that. But Holy War is not that way. A Holy War is very generalized. In fact, you read yourself in its pages. You put yourself into it. And that's the key. And that's why you have to read it. And because you may get something, because it's such a personal sort of book, you might get something different than what somebody else would. It may ring or resonate with you differently than somebody else. But obviously there are some general principles that are brought out. But it's important then that we understand that. I've got the quote up there, but I think this quote kind of sums that up. By means of the many scriptural references, the narrative is explicitly linked to the universal history of the Bible. What that means is that obviously you can't read it without understanding that the author knew the Bible. Drawing the narrative, and the individual who reads himself in it, into the great universal history of creation, fall, and redemption. So this would explain, in general, all that Holy War goes through, and the whole grand story of that famous continent of universe. Okay, so when you read this, then, you're reading yourself in it. It's very personal. The first three chapters, which I'm going to go over briefly today, tonight, are the fall of man. All of us are fallen creatures. All of us. All of us can relate to that. And then the subsequent chapters will go through redemption. So getting, and that's why it's called the Holy War, the fight to gain back man's soul. It's the idea. So it is most important that we understand that man's soul is you. Yes, it's a town in the allegory, but it's you. So it is as if Bunyan is opening you up and walking inside, spiritually speaking, and kind of walking around and seeing different things, as if this is the way that you operate. And so it's you. You're represented then as a medieval town, an English town. And so this is maybe some of the lore and some of the attraction, you might say, of the book, because it has to do with castles and swashbuckling, you might say, that sort of thing. And it was in the days when the towns were governed by a feudal system, everything inside the walls there. And so the characters of the town then represent the different facets of your own personality, yours, and what makes you up. In the classic Bunyan style, these facets are personified as people, and they're given names in the form of titles. And so the governing body of Mansoul then is comprised of three people. And you'll see this by the names. The one is Lord Will Be Will. So his place is in the center of man's soul. So that's your will, your free will. We'll get more into that in a minute. The other one is Captain Resistance. Captain Resistance is very a person of a great conviction. And so he's willing to defend things. And then Lord Innocency, which, appropriately so, when man's soul sins, he dies. Innocency is gone. So it's really a bit of a sad story. In a way, holy war is kind of edgy. What I mean by that is it cuts right to what we are. It cuts right to who we are, fallen creatures. And then the redemption of that fallen creature and how Lord Emmanuel gains back man's soul is the subject of the entire book. So in the first three chapters, then you have in the first chapter is deals with the Diabolos, okay, the devil, and so he has a council meeting. But before that time, John Bunyan deals with the fall of Lucifer in what is the prologue. Now, I have it here, and it's not very long, so I thought I would just read the prologue tonight. And number one, I think it's short enough, but it'll also take up some time for me. So, once upon a time, a long, long time ago, there lived a great king. The name of this king was Shaddai. Now, the word Shaddai in Hebrew basically gives the idea of the all-sufficient one. I love that name. Because the Lord needs nothing at all. He was before there was anything. He doesn't need, whereas we are dependent on Him and what He's created. He is not dependent on anything at all. He is completely and totally self-sufficient. Now, Shaddai had built for himself a great country called Universe. And this country was vast beyond words to describe. It contained enough planets and galaxies of stars to boggle the imagination. As if this were not enough, he had populated it with angels, and over all these angels he had put one angel, wiser and more beautiful than all the others, and this angel's name was Lucifer. You have to say that sort of imposing, Lucifer. Lucifer's task and glory was to carry the government of Shaddai to the angels, to carry back their worship to Shaddai. The situation was perfect, except for one problem. The problem was Lucifer. He was not content with what he had. He wanted to be as powerful as Shaddai himself and persuaded the angels to rebel. Lucifer was confident the rebellion would be successful. It was not. Shaddai brought powerful judgment upon Lucifer and his followers, and they were cast out of heaven and banished to a miserable pit. And in that pit, they play with brimstone a lot. You'll see that when you read it. They play with it as if it's Play-Doh. Lucifer's name was changed from Lucifer to Diabolos. Diabolos in the Greek means to throw a cross. That's what the word means. And so this is why he's called the accuser of the brethren, the root of the Satan. And the story might have ended there, except for one thing. In one corner of the universe was a place called Earth. On it, Shaddai built for himself a town, Mansoul. Diabolos snapped to attention. The story was not over. The story, in fact, was just beginning. Mansoul was Shaddai's delight. What sweeter revenge could Diabolos have than to take it? And so we have a great king, a wonderful town that he built for his pleasure, and a wicked giant who hates him. And on these three things hangs a tale of love and intrigue and adventure, a tale of castles and strongholds, of battles and banners and trumpets, of thunder and fire and blood, of princes and lords, armor shining in the sun, a tale of life and death. And it all began when Diabolos decided to take Mansoul for himself. So there you have my attempt to whet your appetite. Now, in the first three chapters, then, we have this prologue. And that pretty much begins it. And then these chapters, in the beginning, we're introduced to Diabolos. Now, he has a war council. And the war councils have names. Beelzebub, Apollyon, Legion, and Electo. You might say Electo. I've heard of Beelzebub, Apollyon, and Legion. Who's Electo? Well, Electo is from Greek mythology. There was, as it goes, a god, I think, and he was stabbed or something, and his blood that dripped down actually gave birth, this is Greek mythology, okay, it gave birth to three beings called Furies, and one of them is Electo. The other one is Tisiphone, and the other one is, I have it down here, Magiera, which means jealous. So Electo means unceasing in anger. At any rate, they inhabited Hades, which is the unseen underworld. And so undoubtedly Bunyan got these from there. So he was more of a student than just the Bible. Obviously, he understood Greek mythology. And so Diabolos has this war council. And so then the summary of chapter 1. It is called Conspiracy Among the Brimstone. And so the continent of universe, as we said, exists between two worlds, heaven and earth, with Mansoul being the dominion of King Shaddai, having his castle in the center. Now, the town is set up in a particular way. It has five gates, and you might guess this, eye gate, ear gate, the nose gate, the feel gate, and there's another gate I just forgot. Let me see here. What are the senses? So mouth, I guess, is the mouth gate. Okay, so there are five gates. Now, those gates are impenetrable. It is impossible for anybody to penetrate those gates. Impossible. King Shaddai made it that way. However, it can be breached if somebody inside lets them in. And this is where the free will comes in. So you see, he mantles you. You're a castle. And inside, then, are everybody's within what King Shaddai has set up, and everybody's happy and peaceful, and it's wonderful. And then no thought of outside, no thought that anything was wrong. And this is the way it's set up. And very much that's how it is. And in fact, in the narrative, Diabolus is sort of snickering, even laughing at King Shaddai for having made Mansoul so strong and yet so weak. Free will is that way, isn't it? As long as you choose the right thing, it's very strong. But you can just as easily freely choose the wrong thing, in which case it becomes weak. And this is the idea. All of us, every one of us, have at one time in our life chosen the wrong thing, and therefore innocency died in us and we became sinners. So you see, each one of us is here. In regards to the free will, Galatians 5:13 says, "Stand fast in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made you free." In what way are we free? We're free to choose. Jesus tells of the church of Laodicea, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." Then he says, "If any man open it." He doesn't force his way in, does he? To open that up. So the Bible talks about man's free will. It's implied in a lot of scripture passages, and in other ones it is stated directly. In Proverbs 16:9, for example, there it says, "A man's heart deviseth his way, but the Lord directeth his steps." Man's heart devises his own way. We have the freedom. "No one can enter then in any other way. The inhabitants enjoy complete protection. No worry whatsoever." I said I wasn't going to say it, but I'm going to say it. No COVID-19 can get in, nothing at all. Okay. So, in Genesis chapter 2, God created man. Isn't that how it was? God created man and put him in a perfect environment. Gave him everything they needed. Think about it. Think about what Adam gave up. Protection, beauty, everything they need. All of his needs were taken care of, for everything that he needed. And it was impossible for Satan to do anything to him. So this is how it's represented. Now, King Shaddai, and even as in the narrative, who knows why really, delights in man's soul. And so, Diabolus, knowing this, devises a plan to destroy the king's son and take man's soul for an inheritance. So he has this evil council, and they get together and they try to decide how they're going to do this. One of the interesting things is that when they refer to time as where we would say BC, they say BB, which is confusing to the council as much as it was to us when we just heard it. That's before banishment, what it means. Okay, so we have before Christ, they have before banishment. So to them, all of time revolves around the singular history of them being banished, just like for us it's Christ dying on the cross. So, what gate do you suppose Diabolus approaches? He approaches the ear gate, interestingly enough. And just like the serpent came to Eve and said, "Hath God said?" And he spoke to her, approached her that way. Now, the opposition inside the castle, interestingly enough, although it's maybe, I don't know if strange is the right word, but even though the walls were impossible to penetrate, yet inside was a man called Captain Resistance. He was a sort of a military man of sorts. And you might ask, well, why was that necessary if indeed man's soul was made impenetrable? Well, there's the nature of man also. And then, so Diabolus has all these people in his war council, and he in particular tells them to be careful with Captain Resistance, because he knew if that person dies, man's soul is ours. And then there's an innocuous little man. I imagine him that way. Innocuous, like unseemingly not hurtful, named Mr. Illpaws. I don't know why I see him as a very short little man. I think he's kind of in the background, but he's the spokesperson for Diabolus. And so they go out there and they decide they're going to take over and, okay, right through there. Okay, so that's the war council meeting. So they meet. Now, the council then sees, I already said that, Diabolus resigns himself to the fact that he cannot rule over the universe. Although he wants to, he cannot. In a way, he's being realistic because he can't rule over the universe, but he put his attention towards man's soul. That's something that could perhaps be done. And so we think about our adversary, the devil, walking about as a lion seeking who he may devour. The God of this world has blinded the minds, the Bible says. I'll get to that in a minute. In fact, at the end of chapter 1, I'll say it right now, the words are, they considered it quite a heady thing, as if it was the mind that was affected. The Bible teaches that. The God of this world has blinded the minds of them, blinded the minds of the people in the world, that the glorious light of the gospel should not shine on them. And isn't that true? You can give truth to somebody and over again, give them the plain truth of the gospel, and you might as well talk to this. And they could be very intelligent. They could be teachers. They could be professors or very smart, whatever. And when it comes to spiritual things, there's, pardon the term, dumb as a rock. Isn't that something? Isn't it interesting how the Lord has made the gospel in such a way that you have to open your heart to it? And thank goodness that that is that way. In truth, this is all brought out here. So in this council meeting, then they realize, of course, a man's soul cannot be breached, and the only way then is by the consent of those inside. So then the plan goes from not trying to force their way in, but trying to get the people inside to let them in. That's the plan. So that's the battle plan, and so it is deceit. I think I'll just do that. Yep, there it is. It is deceit. After all, that's what it is. And they said they're going to lie. They're going to give lies, and their intentions will be invisible. At one point in the narrative, they say, if they see us, surely they're not going to open the door because they're I can't remember what kind of the word they said, but a ghastly lot or whatever. So they're not going to open the door. And so they said, that's true, but I'm going to be invisible. And so this is where he decides he's going to use a creature that the Lord God had made. And so the serpent was picked. And in the narrative, they say the reason why they picked that is because they wanted to pick. Think of how devious this is. They wanted to pick something that man has control over. So this would make them feel confident or not frightened. They picked something that I know I have dominion over. I'm not going to put up any kind of guards. I'm not going to put up anything. And that's the idea. He wanted a creature that man respects. One of the Lord's creations, something that's wise and beautiful. And of course, they even mention something of the dragon family is what they say. And they pick the serpent. And then at the very end of the council meeting, now that everything was done and they sent their plan into action, he asked Mr. Illpaws to follow them so that if there's any kind of, and the reason why he's called Illpaws, because if there's any kind of hesitation whatsoever, he'll be ready there to strike. So, that's true, isn't even in the Christian life. Jesus said, no man putting his hand to the plow. Looking back, when I think of hesitation, I think of that. So the chapter then closes, chapter 1 that is, with this whole idea, with the plan there. And so then we get to chapters 2 and 3. There it is. And there's the ear gate. There's the ear gate. And it's the fallen enslavement of man's soul. Okay, so let's summarize then chapters 2 and 3. This involves the summons. So chapter 2 gives the characters. You learn a little bit more about the characters in Mansell, who they are, what their characteristics are. And you have Diabolus summoning them. So it's a trumpet blast. And so they sound the trumpet. And people hear it, and it's a bit odd to them. And so Lord Understanding is walking around, and he's making his rounds, what he does every day. And everybody's happy and peaceful, and they hear this odd trumpet blast. It's a summons. And then Mr. Conscience and so forth, and they hear these things. And so then that's chapter 2 is the summons. Chapter 3 then is the assault, where they actually carry out the Diabolus' plan to conquer Mansoul. And this is your fall, the fall of you. So Diabolos comes and he gives a speech, and I think the idea of his words being oily is used, something like that. So he claims in the book, Diabolos claims that he is there to deliver man's soul from bondage. If there's one thing that I think is very, that the devil has the world, hopefully none of us here, is the idea that the Christian life is a life of bondage. Galatians 5 says, stand fast in the liberty wherewith Christ has made you free. In truth, being unsaved and being carnal is enslavement, isn't it? Carnal people are enslaved to their own flesh. They have no freedom to serve God. They have no freedom to do these things. So the devil has got people's minds twisted. And so the same thing with man's soul. So you see, I was deceived at one time. I believed those things. It wasn't too long ago. Well, that's a good ways back now. But I remember it. And I can remember being deceived. I can remember going with the crowd, going with the flow, and thinking like it was such a measure of freedom. But then the consequences start to mount up, and you realize it's not what you thought it was. So, Diabolos suggested then that King Shaddai was keeping something from them. At one point in the narrative, he says, he mentions the word bondage, and I think it's Lord understanding, or maybe says, we didn't know we were in bondage. It's interesting that this light and understanding comes to them. But something that the devil is trying to get the townspeople to believe or think, that the King Shaddai kept that from them. So, and he suggested that the fruit, and of course it was brought out that there was one law. Oh, that's an important thing too. There's one law in man's soul, one only. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and that's it. And then he gave the idea of the fruit. Okay? So Diabolos went to him and suggested that the fruit is only fruit, and of course would give them new knowledge. It says in Genesis chapter 3, verse 3, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, ye shall not eat of it. Now this is Eve's recounting of what the Lord said, or what Adam told her that the Lord said. Neither shall you touch it, lest ye die. And the serpent said unto the woman, ye shall not surely die. Right there, he interjects that. You're not going to die. So at that point, Eve probably thought to herself, well, if we're not going to die, then why did he give these things? But he gave the suggestion. He gave it to you because he didn't want you to know what he knows. He's keeping something from you. And I think that that is a very, very strong pull that the world has on people, maybe young people, maybe people especially that grew up in Christian homes. They have this pull there because they think that they're missing out on something. And you can tell them over and over and over again that that's not so, but there's always that pull. And Satan is very good at that. And this is brought out in the narrative. So you see, we see ourselves in this. Now, the main actions then, leading to the eating of the fruit, as Diabolos is speaking, Alecto Sharpshooter, who in the original book is Tisiphone, but it's not mentioned here, shoots and kills Captain Resistance. So they hesitated. Mr. Ilpaz comes in. There's that moment where their ability to resist is gone. Boy, that happens. Sin will grab you and get you to the point where you cannot resist it. As much as you think, as strong as we think we are, sin has the capacity to weaken us to the point where we cannot resist it. Captain Resistance is killed. He's died. They looked at Captain Resistance in horror. And at that point, then, as the speech goes on, Lord Innocency dies. A sad state of affairs. Each one of us, when we fell, that's what happened. Innocency died in us. And it was gone. We were sinners from that point on. Sad, isn't it? And that's what I'm saying. The book has a bit of an edge on there because you read it and you say to yourself, that's me. That's exactly what happened to me when I sinned. So they had no power to resist now, and so they went ahead and ate the fruit. So what was the results of man's soul's disobedience? Well, of course, when they have no means to resist, they open up the gate. The ear gate was opened up, this one right here. They opened it and they freely let them in. They forgot Shaddai. They forgot his law. They forgot any kind of judgment connected to disobedience. And Satan is very good at that. And they willingly become Diabolos' slaves. They didn't expect that, but that's what happened. And that's what happened with us. So, what does Diabolos do when he gets in there? Well, he removes Mayor Understanding and Mr. Conscience from office because he wants to be the understanding they have, and he wants to manipulate their conscience. Then he builds a house with a high tower so that there would be darkness there. Everything has changed. Will becomes captain of Diabolus' castle because he wants to manipulate the free will. We have to understand, and biblically speaking, everybody's will is subservient. Everybody. And what we mean by that, although it's free, there is really no such thing as I will do what I want. When people say I will do what I want, what they're really doing is obeying their flesh. Either way, you're in servitude. Now, in the garden, man had freedom. And he knew nothing of bondage. But when he disobeyed, then he knew what it was to be a slave. Romans 8:20 says this, and I think it wraps it. It's kind of a pithy way to explain it. For the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly. Interesting. So the words here say he's made subject, but not willingly. Made subject, not willingly. Seemingly, but by reason of him who had subjected the same in hope. Now, John Gill says this about this passage. So Romans 8:20 is talking about people that have sinned, and this idea of the creature was made subject to vanity. This is the idea of being lost. And so he says this about the passage: though they were willingly vain, yet they were not willingly made subject to vanity. The idea is they made the choice to sin, vanity sin. What they didn't realize is that they were going to be made subject to that sin. So people sin thinking that they can go back anytime they want to. And that's the ploy of Satan. I can do this. I'll go out a little bit, test the waters out there, see what it's like, and I can come back anytime I want to. You cannot. We've seen it over and over and over again because sin has that effect, be it deceitful, of binding. It pulls you in. You think that you can stop it. You think that you can turn it off. You think that you can do this, but you realize that once that captive resistance is gone, you have no way to resist. So, then he goes on to say, so they were not willingly subject to vanity. They willingly went into idolatrous and other evil practices, but the devil made them subject or slaves unto them. He led them captive at his will and powerfully worked in them by divine permission, so they became vassals to him and to their lusts. Why is it that people go headfirst into sin when they know it's going to affect them? And when you tell them repeatedly, this is what's going to happen, and when they do it, it happens every time. Why do they do that? Because we have no power to resist these things without Christ. Because once we're sinners, we're enslaved. Diabolus then encourages wickedness and promises peace through pleasure. So then, this is a bit of a trite picture of man's soul, perhaps. And you got some of the characters inside. And I've mentioned some of these things. I won't go too much detail at all. But Lord Mayer understands that he's an explorer. So he goes through and he explores things to try to understand those things. Again, there's a weakness and a strength to all of these things because to gain understanding in good things is good. But you can just as easily gain understanding of things that are not good. So again, that free will is brought out. Then man's soul is created, is beautiful, is given power. We mentioned that. Mr. Conscience, he is untiring. He is his characteristics in the book is that he never gets tired. He's at the very center of man's soul. So it's that spiritual part. It's our conscience, and we know what that is. Captain Resistance, we mentioned him. Lord will be will. This is the free will. His job was to inspect the walls and gates. He understands that nobody can get in without consent. And he understands God's love versus man's free will. And that he is not commanded to love him in return. That is brought out in the book and I thought was very interesting. God's love is freely given to the inhabitants of man's soul. And he does not demand that love in return. That love in return is freely given. Then we mentioned Mr. Ilpaz. So then Diabolus' ploy. Yep. All right, Austin, here we go. Here's where the trouble comes in. Help me out there. Technical difficulties. So then Diabolus then has got his ploy. And I've only got a couple more slides, and maybe I'll just tell you. So the thing about Satan that is, well, one of the things is that he has never changed his tactics. They're the same as they've always been. The Bible tells us in 2 Corinthians 2:11 that we are not ignorant of his devices. He tries to get man to forget that there's judgment. And he tries to get man to believe that he can be God. Work salvation, really, is man, is the deification of man. But it is. The idea of no judgment. People don't think about judgment. People don't like to think about hell. They don't like to think about the what their actions will take them to. They don't think about it. The devil has a way to blind them. It's not true for you. So he comes as a friend. And then man's soul falls. They were lost. Then they willingly allowed Diabolus to be their king. And this was our... This is us. And we fell. And I think one of the saddest things in the book there is where Lord Innocency dies. I don't think that anywhere in the book, to my knowledge, does he become alive again. At least not in the first three chapters. I don't know that. But once that is gone, it's gone. And it's really a sad thing, isn't it? And what's even sadder, maybe to me, is when people are in church and they're fallen and they're not saved. And they sit here service after service. I don't know, my mind went to this when I was looking at this. Jesus said there's tares among the wheat. And I think sometimes we think of tares as people that are preach false doctrine or heresy or that kind of thing. That's not a tare, because a tare looks just like the wheat. They look exactly the same. You cannot tell the difference. Our Altore said one time, and I don't know if this number is right, but he said he saw countless numbers of people saved, supposedly. But he said that he didn't think but 10% of the people that actually made confessions were actually saved. Again, he's a man. He came up with those numbers. We can't say that for sure. But nowhere in the Bible are we to tell people that they're saved, to work out their own salvation. I think that if anybody here is confused about it, I would not go one single more day, not one day. I mean tomorrow. Clear your schedule. Go somewhere where you're all by yourself and open up the Bible and read it until you know. If you go one more day, then you're just like man's soul that falls. You've fallen for the ploy of the devil. And I can't help to believe there are people like that here. So, settle it. You might say to yourself, well, sometimes I think that I'm not trying to get you to doubt it, but if there are doubts, and when you go to the Bible and there's still doubts, then settle it. Settle it. Take care of it. Because if you don't, the devil again has a way to get you to forget the judgment of God, and you'll answer one day for that, and there's no need. So the fall of man is a sad thing. The rest of the book is kind of getting it back again, and that's what we're going to go into. But think about your fall. Think about your salvation. Think about how the devil deceived and how we were deceived. And what a sad, horrible thing would be for somebody to sit here and to be deceived to the point where they never make that decision. And get the book and read it. And the Lord bless you with some understanding.